Welcome to Living with Dying, a podcast where we're going to talk about the unspeakable, everything to do with death and dying, and how to live with it. We're all on the same journey towards the end, but we just never talk about it. We don't like to think of our own life ending, and we certainly don't like to contemplate losing our nearest and dearest. So we all join in this huge conspiracy, pretending it won't happen to us. And then, when it does, we're often ill-prepared. So we're saying, let's talk about death. Let's open up the subject, and by listening to other people's stories, glean some advice and tips on how best to approach death, how to deal with loss, and how to rebuild a life after. So today I'm talking to Andrew Peters, who sadly has lost his father, and then his father 10 years ago, and his brother quite recently. What would you like to talk about first, Andrew? Which one of those?
I was going to say neither, but I suppose my father. Yeah, probably. That was 2010, and it was very sudden. So it was a shock. You know, he'd been fine, and in fact, I'd spoken to him earlier that particular week when he became ill, and he was going to work. So he was 80,
and still at work.
Still working, yeah. He was coming down from 5 days a week to four or three days a week. But he loved working. It kept him going mentally and physically. And so he'd left as usual early morning, left for work. Used to get up at 5:30 and be in London by 7 o'clock. Have breakfast in London, then go to his meetings. And I got a phone call. I was on my way into London. And I got a phone call saying he'd had a stroke in a meeting. So he'd been taken to St. Thomas's Hospital. So I got there a few hours later, obviously frantically calling my mother and my brothers. Couldn't get hold of any of them. I think my mother was at the hairdresser's, bizarrely. And then I got there and he was sitting up in bed. He was fine. And he had a stroke. They put a blood clotting, an anticoagulant into him to stop the bleed in his brain, which seemed to be working. I said, well, why don't I go and I'll take your car and take it home. He parked it in the usual car park that he used. And he said, well, no, you don't need to take my car. I'll bring it back later on. We'll probably need to book somewhere for dinner later on tonight. Or I might even be in for one night, but I don't know yet.
So he felt well.
He felt absolutely fine. And he was sitting up and smiling and chatting. And then literally within 2 hours, he had another massive stroke. And basically he never really recovered from that. So he wasn't in a coma, but he could talk, but very sporadically. He could recognize who was around. And you could tell when people were there, it lifted him up. So my mother and brothers arrived that evening, and my mother obviously, you know, had conversations to him rather than with him, because he was not really making a lot of sense when he was trying to talk and couldn't really talk. So left side had pretty well gone completely, and right side was pretty well gone as well. Yeah, so it was a really tough time. Mum had had prior evening with Dad, she'd had one of those sort of conversations that you often have as couples, which is he'd sat downstairs and he was watching TV, and you know, he should have probably gone to bed, but he'd fallen asleep on the sofa. And she was a bit cross with him, and told him he needed to come up to bed. And eventually he did. And that was it. And that was the last conversation they had, because she never got the chance to speak to him again. And so he was there so that was the Monday. And he died on the Friday. So 5 days. And it was tortuous, really, because it was clearly... he was dying, and the question then was timing and making him comfortable. So that was the whole target of the hospital, and the hospital were incredible. The specialists were amazing, nurses extraordinary. And I said, again, I've got quite a number of children, so I had to tell my children, obviously, which was even now a hard thing to do. Badly. My eldest, he was at boarding school, so I had to go there and ask to see him and then bring him up. But as soon as he saw my father, my father's lit up, his face lit up. You could just tell that that was kind of what helped him. And he was sort of babbling and not making a lot of sense. So it wasn't as if you could have a conversation. So the children all saw him, which was great, and but not a lot they could do. And then his brother and sister as well. So they came up. So, and everybody really was coming up, well, essentially to say goodbye. That was the what was happening. And then I remember, so we'd left him on the Friday night because there was nothing we could do, and Mum was tired, and she'd been staying up there all week, as we all had, and she wanted to go and have some food, so we decided to take her away. And while as we went, literally, we sat down to have some dinner, and he passed away whilst we were having dinner. So he was on his own. But I think I spoke to somebody about this afterwards, and they said that quite often people who are dying wait until everybody's out of the room, and then they go because they don't like it happened. Somebody actually told me a story at the time of somebody at St. Thomas's who had requested that his family came over, and then hurried them out of the room and was dead an hour later. So I think there's something in that, and the last sense to go, so I understand, is hearing. So you kind of feel, as you say something, that that's having an impact and doing something. But Mum was obviously devastated, not surprisingly, but I think part of it was because, A, going back to the last conversation she'd had with him, B, thinking about, the future for her, obviously being on her own. And then Saturday morning, I got a phone call from my aunt to say that my uncle had had a heart attack and died on the Saturday. So that's my mother's sister. So my mother's sister lost her husband, and my mother lost her husband effectively almost on the same day. These things aren't a competition to see who gets upstairs first, but it almost... The sisters have been competitive in the past. It almost felt like that. It was slightly weird. But yeah, I remember getting home, and in fact, my youngest, Zach, so at the time he would have been, two or three. And my father, we called him Bumper, because he used to bump his head on the swimming pool when he was swimming. And that was what the kids, all the grandchildren called him. And I bought my father's car back to our house. And he came out, so yes, he was about three, and he said, why is Bumper's car here? So he knew at three. I mean, extraordinary. And he was an amazing man. So he'd set up business in the community, he'd set up London First, he'd done a lot of things, charitable things, as well as been done well in business. And very private, so if we had anything wrong with us as kids, if we were ill or whatever, you just had to get on with it. There was no quarter given or asked. You had to just crack on.
So stiff upper lip.
Absolutely. I think that was how they brought up in those days, during the war and all of that period, was all about, family stuff. You keep quiet, keep it within the family. And you, if you're ill or unwell or whatever, then it doesn't matter. And in 2010, for us was a big year, because my son had played rugby for England under 16s. My father had come out to Italy to watch him play, and we'd noticed that he was a little bit slower in walking, and my mother was commenting on it. So there was clearly something wrong and happening. But yeah, I think it was the suddenness. I think I've had friends whose parents have died having had a bit of time, with cancer or something, it was all horrible. But at least had that time to almost say goodbye. And that, I think my mother certainly felt, we all felt, there was none of that. We didn't have a chance to say anything. And funnily enough, we were all going to sit down as a family and talk about, what would happen if, what would he want how would we want to look after mum, etc., etc. And he left letters for us that he'd written over the years as to, you know, what he'd like to happen for mum, you know, stay in the house and look after her. And we all live quite close together, so it was yeah, it was quite a traumatic time.
Sounds like he was very organised. But can I just go back a bit to you? And you said it was the suddenness that upset you most. Did you have the kind of relationship in the years leading up to when he was suddenly taken ill, where you were very open and talk about everything?
We were very close. He was, I mean, I probably spoke to him, three or four times a week, and, you know, played tennis together. And yeah, he was, yeah, he was, obviously, he was my dad, but he was a, you know, tremendous friend.
So it was a particularly hard thing for you to accept.
Yeah, I found it very hard. I found, I knew I was going to have to speak at the funeral, for example, and I knew I had to do it, but I didn't really want to do it. And also, he'd laid out what he wanted to happen. So he wanted a family funeral, quiet, you know, just the family, that was it. And then later on, sometime, so he died in May, so he wanted something later on, so July, August time, in the summer, a memorial service, to which, you know, whoever comes to that wants to. And that was incredible. I mean, it was packed. It was, you know, there were enormous number of people there. The king now, but Prince Charles as he was, had written a eulogy for him, which was incredible. It was lovely, and it was really heartfelt because they'd known each other for a long time. So, because he'd been involved in business of the community, as obviously the king is the patron of business of the community. So that was, you know, it was really important for him, and also, and Dad had started it up with a couple of other people as well. So they had that affinity, and then he started writing a book as well. So years before, I'd said to him, listen, you know, obviously at some point something's going to happen, hopefully not for years, but in the meantime, I'd like to understand your story. You know, how did you start, and, you know, when you were born and your family and background. And obviously he talked about it, but he'd never written anything down for us to keep. And I'm like you said earlier, he was very organized, and he had recorded and written effectively a book, which was about his life. And it was really interesting because he was a more emotional man as he got older. But growing up, I wouldn't have called him an emotional father. I mean, I almost kissed my father and hugged him. But he was never, like I said earlier, you need to get on with things. That was his sort of mantra. So that was very different for him as he started to write the book. I thought he'd start to become a bit more emotive about things. And so when he talked about my mother, for example, he says, I met the love of my life. But that was it. He didn't say anything else. And then, you know, the boys came along because we were three boys. But there's no emotion in it. There was no how he felt about us or anything, which in a way I felt was quite sad because I never... that wasn't something that you could hold on to historically. I mean, he told us.
Are you saying you would have liked to see him being more emotional with your mother while he
was
alive?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, you could tell they loved each other, and it was a very, very strong relationship. But I mean, I always remember from my own point of view, you know, I remember saying to my father as he was lying, you know, dying, I remember telling him I loved him, and he said, so it's a bit late now.
Oh.
And that was kind of the only sort of slightly funny, but, you know, thing that he said that was actually hit me, because I didn't say it often enough, I'm sure.
I think that is part of the point of this podcast, is to learn what we could be doing when people are alive, so we don't get left with regrets afterwards. And if we don't tell people we love them while they're alive, it is too late. isn't it, when they've gone? I mean, you expect people to understand it, but that's not quite the same as saying it. And one of my regrets that I've mentioned before is that I didn't thank Michael for giving me such a good life.
Yeah.
We knew we loved each other, but, you know, there's so much more we could have said. So, yes, I think that's part of the point.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that is sometimes the most difficult thing, but, you know, in a sense, it should be easy. But you forget it, or you don't say it, or you don't say it often enough.
But you did say it.
I did say it.
And
the answer was classic, really. It was almost what I expected.
But you know he heard it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's good.
Yeah, that was the big thing. You know, for my mother, I think, you know, the difficulties for her were, you know, trying to move on after that, being on your own, it is, as you know, is very difficult. It's a new life. You know, you can have all the friends around you and everything else, but that doesn't make up for everything else. And she didn't go in. So when he was in the funeral parlor, she never went to see him, and she regretted that. So that was a big thing for her. Nobody said she shouldn't, but just said, if you want to do, and she said no, she didn't want to. And years later, this year, when my brother died, she did go and see my brother.
So is it time to move on to talk about your brother? We'll come back to your father, but tell me about your brother as well.
Well, we seem to have a thing about sudden deaths in our family. So he had had a heart attack and a stroke before he was 50, so when he was relatively young. He was, people would call him a house husband or whatever you call it, but he was dedicated to his kids. You know, he had three boys, has three boys, they're still around. Very, very close family. You know, his wife and three boys, and he'd do anything for those boys. So his because he was brought up in a household with three boys. I'm slightly older than them, so I'm 7 years older than him, and he was brilliant. He gave up a lot, and he, you know, worked very hard at it, and was very, very close to them because he was there for them all the time. Skiing was a big part of their life. So every winter, as a family, when we were growing up, we went skiing. My parents went up, their honeymoon was a skiing honeymoon, and that was a big thing for us. Christmas and New Year was normally away somewhere skiing. And the boys obviously all learnt as they were young, from the age of sort of two or three, they had skis on and off they went. So they went on a ski holiday last year and together as a family. And I got a phone call. It was just after Christmas Day, it must have been Boxing Day or the day after. From my other brother, saying that he'd had a heart attack and he was in hospital. Hard in France.
A long way away.
A hell of a long way away. So obviously with my mother, how do we tell her and when do we tell her and all that sort of stuff? And was he going to get through it or not? And as we found out more about what had happened, so he had not been feeling 100%, so he'd been back at the chalet. And he'd phoned his wife and said, look, I think we need to get an ambulance. And then they got a helicopter to take him down. They needed to take him down to the hospital. And for some reason, the helicopter wasn't taking off. And we found out later that he'd just had a massive heart attack and basically went into a coma pretty well from there on. So he never spoke again. He was taken then to Grenoble, which is the most amazing hospital for, I mean, you know, if you're going to be anywhere in France and you need that sort of care, that would be the place to be. And they were absolutely amazing. And he was on a heart bypass machine, and he could, because he couldn't breathe by himself, so breathing tubes. And my younger brother was the youngest brother. You know, they're very close. So they were born, you know, literally sort of just over a year apart. So they'd done everything together. You know, they played golf together and their families were, you know, close. You know, there's 11 grandchildren around. So they'd always been tremendously close. Both wives, very close, and both of them. So it was very, very difficult for him. And then the question in our heads was, when do we tell mum? And when we tell mum, does one of us need to be here, or do we, because he was out there, because they were skiing, they were out there together. I felt very strongly that I wanted to go there. So I'd spent time with mum, obviously explaining to her what was happening. Her view was that I should go. And I wasn't sure whether, am I going sort of for me in a way, because, it might be a goodbye, or am I going, what can I do? How can I help? Because I'm not really going to be able to do anything. I'm not a doctor and not a specialist. Am I better off being at home and sitting with mum? And I just thought I wasn't. I thought I probably more for me, I guess. I think I had to go. So I got on a plane and went out there and saw him. And it was, obviously his sons were there, and it was awful. He was lying down, tubes coming out of him all over the place. And you get these points in all of this where the nurses almost are like to give you hope, which is a lovely thing to do, but you also need a bit of reality. And with my father, I remember we were talking to one of the nurses, and she said, "Oh, I think he looks a lot brighter today." And we both looked at him and brighter. I mean, he's in a coma and he's not talking. And what are you talking about? And she was saying, "Well, he could recover from this." And we're like, "All right, he's not going to recover. He's dying." And they were never quite like that in France. They were always measured. But there came a point, I can't remember which day it was, but it was about second or third day that I was there. So it was around about the beginning of January. And I'd been with him on New Year's Eve, just sitting in the room with him. And my brother and I had got him to blink twice for yes, because the easy thing is to blink once for yes, because that doesn't take too much effort. And he seemed to be able to do that. So we kind of thought, okay, so there must be some sort of brain function going on here. So the big thing was to take him off the bypass, the heart bypass. And if he could survive that, then potentially there was an opportunity for him to survive completely. And I remember they took him off the heart bypass. My younger brother and I then, we'd obviously gone out. We came back about 4 or 5 hours later, and expecting to be told that he wasn't there, only to be told he was back in his room and he was off the heart bypass. So that made us think, wow, what if he can get off that? Then they need to obviously check his brain activity and all of this sort of stuff. And then I left to come home, and he passed away on the 5th. For his wife, same thing as mum, never having had that opportunity, in a sense, to say goodbye. Because he went from saying, "I'm not feeling 100%, but look, I've got to go to the hospital. I'll be back in a few hours, or maybe they might keep me in overnight," to not being there at all.
So he was speaking to her before.
Oh yeah, he'd spoken to her. He'd said, "Don't worry, I know what this is. I've had one of these before." Quite relaxed about it, as he was normally about that sort of thing.
So it then comes as a bigger shock, doesn't it?
I think so. Yeah, and difficult to deal with. And back to your point about, telling somebody that you love them, that wasn't an issue for the two of them. But I think for the kids particularly, and obviously for Octavia as well, not having had that opportunity to say goodbye, to have a conversation, to talk about life without him, what it'd be like, etc., was just absolutely devastating. It does make you realise that your friendship group really rallies around and helps and supports, particularly for the boys. So the youngest was actually 18 on the 1st of January. And his father dies on the 5th. So they'd arranged a party, obviously. So, for his wife, what does she do? Does she go back? Because there's nothing she can do in the hospital. Does she go back, be with her son, who wasn't at the hospital, had gone back home, because he needed his friends around him and he needed that care. And I suppose you know, you everybody deals with it in different ways, don't they? Everybody, you either want people around you, you want to be on your own. There's a variety of different aspects to it.
But for an 18-year-old to decide whether to have his birthday party or not must have been really tough.
Yeah, and it ended up with, you know, family and cake and some friends around and not the party that he'd obviously been expecting that he would have at some point, which he was going to have in the summer. But, you know, him and his dad were tremendously close because he'd looked after him from day one, you know, and now he's doing his mocks and then he's got his A-levels coming up and he's hopefully going to uni. What happens about that? The eldest boy was not enjoying his job, but thinking, you know, what he wanted to do next and was talking to his dad about it. So there was a lot going on in the family.
And we're talking here not just about your grief, but you're taking on responsibility or worry about all those around you, aren't you, who are also feeling?
Yeah, I think, you know, I suppose I was always taught by my father that you sort of assume this, I don't know, like head of the family role, if you like. So you've got to be as strong as possible for everybody else, and you've got to not look after everybody else, but you've got to at least care and show that you care. And then you've got your own children and wife to deal with and work with as well. So you've got all of that. I'm not saying that's not a bad thing, but
how did you balance it out? Did you have enough time for yourself, your own grief?
Probably, as you can tell, probably not. I think I probably didn't. I think I boxed things up and tried to go, right, okay, so that's happened now. Yeah, so when my father died, it was, right, okay, so we're going to get through the first few things, you know, the funeral, the memorial service, get those out of the way, sort mum out, make sure she's okay and happy and comfortable. My middle brother is amazing because he wasn't working, he was around for mum a lot. So actually him being around, being able to go and visit her, and yeah, he was great at dropping in, you know, every Friday, but also during the week as well, he'd just drop in and see her. And that wasn't going to, once he'd gone, that wasn't obviously going to happen anymore. My other brother works, yeah, away from home. I, at the time, was, for the last few years, been working up in Norfolk. So I haven't been around during the week at all, and you know, wasn't getting back till Friday night and then leaving Sunday afternoon. So trying to balance all that with time spent is always difficult. And you then got to decide, in a way, or I had to decide, you know, sort of who needed help and support the most in terms of the boys or his wife, or yeah, out of the family. And I felt that the eldest boy probably needed more support, help, guidance, whatever, just somebody to be there, not as a father figure, but just as, you know, an uncle that if you want to have a chat about something, you can, and you can talk about anything. It's not, you know, and talk about your dad. And so I tried to do that, but also you got to think, you can't be pushy. And, you know, how often do you phone people up and say, how are you? You know, I don't phone his wife up every week and say, how are you? And I do speak to my mum quite a lot, but I don't think you can, you know, it's that balance is really difficult from the outside. And then, as you say, you've got your own grief as well, but you sort of put that to one side. So you think, well, I'm going through nothing compared to, you know, what his family's going through. Just appalling.
It sounds like you're very good at looking after other people and worrying about what they might need from you. Can you tell me what you would have wanted for yourself?
I don't know. I think I've been lucky. I've had love and support of my wife and family anyway, and my, you know, five children have been great. I'm not sure whether I probably wanted to cry more, maybe talk more openly sometimes. I mean, I talk openly as a family, but I mean, not external. I've never, you know, gone to grief counselling or anything like that, or not that that wouldn't be a good thing for me to do, but just I just never. I always sort of thought if I could deal with it myself and put it to one side. And the other thing is keeping busy. So I know, for example, my brother's wife, that, you know, she's very, very busy. And work is a big thing for her, but also, you know, now the three boys have left home. They're at university and one of them's working abroad. So that's really hard. And so, you want to sort of help in some way, but then on the other hand, you know, there's lots of friends around that. So it's a balance. For myself, yeah, probably. I mean, you know, probably you could tell, I probably should talk about it with other people. To be honest, yeah.
Keeping busy is very good displacement activity, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah, and if you've got things to occupy you all the time, you just don't think about it. But then when you do think about it, that's when it hits you. Yeah, definitely.
Does it hit you unexpectedly sometimes?
Yeah, I think different things would hit me if it's, I don't know, like if I'm playing golf or something, then, you know, that was a part of our lives when we were growing up. So something like that would hit me. Or if I, you know, if I'm getting text messages or whatever from his eldest boy who's now away, becoming a ski instructor, that does, I think about it a bit more about, you know, that sort of life on your own at that age. You know, I think when you're older and your father dies, it's hard. But you kind of think it's almost not that bad to a degree. But then when you're young, you know, if you're, you know, 18, 19, well, if you're really young, that's all horrendous. But if you're 18, 19, 20, you know, you're in the sort of formative years of going through uni, leaving, starting work, doing all that sort of stuff. And I think and the timing of it is just horrific. Yeah.
Are you able with your nephews to cry together? Because you say you don't think you cried enough. Is that something you've done with them?
No. No. No, I think I've always tried to show outwardly that I can cope with it. I think that was part of how I was brought up. I'm quite an emotional person. I mean, I used to cry at EastEnders and stuff like that. I cry at most things, to be honest. But I try not to show that to other people other than my own immediate family, kids and so on. And I, you know, with all the other stuff for me, it's been quite an emotional journey anyway over the last sort of two or three years. So that plays a part as well. So I think seeing that from another perspective probably makes me want to make sure that I'm okay. I think I need to tell my family that I'm fine. Don't worry about me. You worry about yourselves.
So where does the support for Andrew come from?
That's a good question. probably talking to the Robin that I think is my father that lands on the lands on the bench outside the house, probably. Yeah, talking to myself, I think, and talking to my father. Yeah.
What do you say to the Robin?
We have quite a few good chats actually about life and what's going on and what I'm doing and what I'm worried about if I'm thinking about things, whether it be work or family life or health or all of those things. It's a bit of a one-way conversation, to be fair, but I think it helps. It just helps get it out. And then occasionally I will have a, you know, my wife knows, you know, we'll have a meltdown, but it doesn't happen that often. I just burst into tears, just, yeah, get very, very emotional and upset. And I think it's when I think about it more, to the point you made earlier, when I've got time and I'm not thinking about it, and I'm working or I'm doing whatever, that's fine. When I'm sitting there thinking or looking at a photo or remembering something, that's when it gets difficult.
I think it's really hard because we need that time, don't we, when we're quiet and still, to reflect and remember. But at the same time, we try to tell ourselves it's not good for us, but it kind of is good for us, isn't it? Because really being sad and allowing yourself to be sad is what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, I think when I was younger, I would have said, you know, it was not a good thing to be showing emotion and getting upset about things. Because that wasn't the way in which I was brought up. As I've got older, I think I've realised with my own children that it is important, and it is important to show that you do have that emotion, because, you know, there are things in life that are, you know, that are really important and sad, and you've got to make sure that, you know, you visibly show that those things do have an impact. Because I think otherwise everybody thinks, oh, well, he's fine, you know, he's working through it, he's all right. And you're not. And in fact, one of my daughters, her boyfriend's father died recently, again, quite suddenly through cancer. And when you see that, or you see it happen to friends, then you realize even more, you know, how close that hits to people, and how, you know, you can't just sweep under the carpet and go, right, let's get on with it. You know, I know my mother still gets terribly upset. You know, my other brother's going into hospital next week. Yeah, and she's obviously desperately worried that, you know, she lost one son, she doesn't want to lose another one or another one. So, you know, and she almost feels guilty that she's still around and everybody else is suffering, which is crackers, but that's what she feels. And I'll probably get more in tune with her feelings now than I would ever have done. I was never particularly emotional with my mother, for example. I was more emotional with my father.
So that's good for your mother to have your support in that respect. You understand her.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
But coming back to you, I think I'm struggling to get you to answer what kind of support you'd like for yourself. Yeah. You're obviously so good at supporting other people. You put yourself into other people's shoes. You think about what they're going through. Can I try and pin you down to what kind of support you would have liked, maybe, that you didn't get, or how you would have liked other people to treat you, talk to you?
I think people recognizing what had happened, you know, and being able to talk about it. Yeah, a lot of people will say, oh, you know, I'm sorry to hear this. But then you kind of feel that's it. And particularly with my brother, a lot of my friends didn't know him. So that makes that a bit more difficult to ask questions. But then talking about it with people that, you know, his friends. So that's definitely helped. I think if I'd probably spent more time getting emotional with my mother about it, probably would help. So she gets emotional when she talks about him, but then very quickly, stoically goes, anyway, moving on. But she does need to talk about him. And I recognize that. But I suppose I struggle in how to talk about him to get her to open up a bit more. And also for me to open up a bit more as well. And I think as a family, we're not great at, when I say as a family, I mean my mother and brothers and my father, we were not great at telling each other, you know, how we felt about things, how emotional we were about things. Also, I do tend to sweep it under the carpet with my kids, because I'll be, you know, they'll ask how I am, and I'll say I'm fine. Now, that's a classic Peter's response, is I'm fine. That's our sort of, that's almost our motto. Whereas with my wife, it's very different. If she asks how I am, I'll tell her, and I'll really tell her. But then that puts I feel that puts the burden on her. So then I'm trying not to tell her, and I know, in answer to your question, I probably need to talk to other people outside of family and removed from the environment who can understand kind of how I feel, but also can maybe give me help in understanding how to manage it a bit better than I do. I mean, I think placing the burden, you know, on my wife is not fair, but then trying not to place the burden on her means that I don't tell her, and then she wonders why I'm being quiet or I'm acting in a certain way, and that's not fair either. So this is a big balance somewhere along the line.
This is really the crux of the whole thing, isn't it, really? Because I think as a society, we don't talk about death. And so if somebody's died, other people tend to tiptoe around you and they say, how are you? Like you just said, but they don't really want to know. And I appreciated one person who visited soon after Mike died, who said, how are you? And I said, I don't know how I'm supposed to be. I don't know, really. But then he went on and said, no, how are you really? And that gave me then the opportunity to be upset and tell him.
Yeah, that's funny because my mother feels very strongly that people do exactly that. Ask her, how are you? And no sooner have they asked than they're on talking about the next thing. And she wants to say, well, hold on a minute, let me tell you how I really am. But she doesn't. And again, she was a grief counsellor. She worked for Cruise as a bereavement counsellor. So she knows what it's like to be on the other side. But she also feels tied that, you know, she wants to help her daughter-in-law, but how does she? You know, she can't drive anywhere. And, you know, I mean, she could get in a taxi and go and see her. And then she doesn't want to sort of interfere. She knows that her grief is very different from mum's grief, but similar because, you know, it was sudden, but the age is very different. And she wants to help in some way. And the help that she gives is probably generational as well. It will be, you know, making a shepherd's pie or something, or making a pudding, because that's how you can help, or sending some flowers, or doing something to brighten up her day.
So why don't we ask each other, what would you like?
I think we need to do that. Yeah. I mean, my mother's not a great hugger. So, you know, if you hug her, she sort of almost sort of backs off and retreats. If it makes her feel very uncomfortable. Whereas my father was a hugger. So, and I'm a hugger. So it's very different. And so trying to appreciate and understand that when you're slightly different, even though you've been brought up in that way, is actually quite a difficult thing to do. Because I do want to give her a hug and, you know, tell her I love her. But if I give her a hug and tell her I love her, she sort of almost backs off. So I think, well, there's no point, which is wrong. I need to have more open conversations, I think, with people in general, because it's very easy to mask things and try and deal with things. And whether that be, you know, personal, emotional things happening at work, things happening in any part of your life. I think I've always done that, you know, sort of compartmentalized it and gone, right, well, okay, let's park that and let's crack on with something else. And then if it comes up again, I'll deal with it. So I think there are certainly more open conversations that I need to have as a family unit outside of, you know, particularly probably with my mother and my other brother. Yeah, and he's found it incredibly difficult to lose, you know, what was essentially his closest buddy, you know, as well as his brother. So I think for me, giving more time to that and not removing myself, because sort of almost removing myself from it and not being engaged every day, you know, not calling my sister-in-law up every day or every week saying, how are you? It's not necessarily the wrong thing to do, but I think doing it in moderation and understanding more about each other and what each other needs is what I need to do.
Have you got any advice for other people based on all your hard experience?
Gosh, that's a good question. I suppose don't bottle it up. Let it out. Let people know how you feel. And I think to your point earlier, when you ask people how they are, really mean it. And be prepared for a response that may not be what you expect. Not being afraid to be emotional with anybody. I think you have to let that out and not try and hold it all in, show some kind of strength that isn't really there. And if you're feeling weak, don't think it's a weakness. It's actually a strength to demonstrate that you do have emotion. You're not being weak, and you're not, you know, it's not something that you should keep into yourself, because what that does end up happening is it will end up sort of almost eating away at you and making you worse in a sense in terms of how you feel. And you're not going to, I don't think you ever get over death in whatever form it is, because it's very personal and it hits everybody in a different way. So you've got to understand that, I think, with each other as a group, as a family, as friends, that, you know, people will want different things, and how you react to that is really important.
I think that's really sound advice. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
We'll be having more chats in future episodes about everything to do with death and dying, such as how to prepare for it, what it's really like when someone dies, how to talk about it, what kind of plans to make, how different cultures and faiths approach dying and bereavement, lots more around grief and loss, how to support others in their sadness, and my personal hobby horse, how to rebuild a life, a good life, after the loss of someone special. If you'd like to join us to talk about the death of someone near to you, if this episode has resonated with you and you have a story to share, or if you've been affected by some of the issues raised, please do get in touch at hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.